Thank you all for coming. My younger brother actually speaks Danish, but I don't. And I have no way of channeling him right now. So. The first thing I want to say is that Denmark is such a great country. I first came to Europe in 1968. And I think my favorite country in Europe was Denmark. I only went to Copenhagen, but I just thought it was just a great place. Remember the Tivoli Gardens? So, yeah, I've always loved Denmark, and it's just a great country. Yes. So, the topic, philosophy. I guess by philosophy here, we should take it in the literal sense of the Greek word philosophia, love of wisdom. There's a reason why even today, let's say, at least in America, I think in Europe also, if someone gets a PhD, say, in biology or history, but somehow it's a love of wisdom degree, a doctor of philosophy. And if you study the intellectual history of the West, and I guess the way things turned out of the world, originally, philosophy was meant to include mathematics, biology, history, of course, what we might call philosophy or metaphysics, social philosophy, political philosophy, and just about everything, because they had a notion that there is a unity of knowledge, that ultimately there's only one world or one... By that, I don't mean to say there's only the material universe, but there's only one reality, and that there are different aspects of reality. There's obviously historical, biological, geological, astronomical, metaphysical. There's all these different dimensions or facets or aspects, but there's only one reality. And so therefore, every branch of knowledge, every attempt to understand the world is in alliance with, it's working with every other branch of knowledge. And unfortunately, this sort of happy situation, it was temporarily interrupted by the collapse of the Roman Empire and the onset of the Dark Ages. By the way, terms like Dark Ages, it's not just us stigmatizing a previous age. Actually, that terminology of Dark Ages comes from the early fathers of the Renaissance. People like Petrarch and Dante. They basically looked around and realized, oh my God, we're in a Monty Python movie. And so then they looked back and they realized that, hey, we used to have a great civilization right here in Italy or in the Greco-Roman world. And so to give credit, the Renaissance really started in the Islamic world. 1,000 years ago, the situation was sort of reversed in the sense that Western Europeans were very much terrorists and fanatics, and the Islamic world was sort of enlightened, multicultural, and liberal in many places, not everywhere. And that's why we have all these words, all these Arabic words that begin with al, like algebra, alcohol, alkaline, because they were the scientists, and they were the mathematicians, and they were the doctors, and they were the ophthalmologists, and so on. Anyway, so the Renaissance finally came to Europe, and I hope you don't mind this little historical preface. I know you were hoping for something more religious and sectarian, but but I'll eventually get to that. So, the Renaissance hit, and again, that's another Renaissance word. That was their word for it, the Renaissance. And if you think about it, it was a very bold thing to do, because in a world which was very much, in those days, the kingdom of Christ on earth, they said, actually, there was a great civilization which was pagan. So that was kind of gutsy. And interestingly, the Vatican, was one of the early patrons of the Renaissance. And the things like the trial of Galileo, that's a later chapter. But in the beginning, the church thought, hey, this is nice, knowledge, culture. So everything was going very nicely. They were reviving the old, how should I put it, the old classical unity of knowledge, where there are different branches of knowledge, everyone working together, teamwork. Aristotle, for example, is the one that talked about physics and metaphysics as two branches of the same knowledge, in a sense. Then what happened? Well, there was actually the type of North European backlash against a renaissance of Southern European pagan culture. Oh. Yeah, if I see anything that is not clear, please feel free to communicate with each other. So, after all, this is your country. So, I don't want to be unkind to Martin Luther, but the facts are the facts here. And the general perception of the Protestant Reformation is that it was this heroic protest against Catholic corruption. And the corruption in the church, which was monumental, but the corruption in the church was actually only the trigger. That was actually the trigger of the Reformation. And when the church realized that they're seriously losing market share, to use modern language, they started correcting themselves and they started reforming everything. So, but by that time, the Reformation had actually moved on to a much, in a sense, much more serious objection to the Catholic Church. And this objection was theological, because corruption can be fixed. But if people become convinced that someone has misunderstood God or is preaching a false doctrine, then that's hard to fix. And so Luther was actually, in a sense, in a real sense, he rejected the Renaissance. For example, some of his slogans were, if you know Latin, sola fide, only faith. In other words, not even Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas was definitely an undesirable character because he had, as everyone said, merely baptized Aristotle. Aquinas was up to his eyeballs in pagan philosophy, but he Christianized it, and so Aquinas was no good. Philosophy was unnecessary, and the new science was another bad thing. And so if it hadn't been for this doctrine, Galileo might have never gone on trial. But what happened is that this sola fide, only faith, and sola scriptura, only scripture. No other source of knowledge is necessary. The world is not a nice place, so why study it? The only thing we need to know about the world is that it's evil, and we need to transcend it. And there's really nothing more that you really need to know about the world. So it's interesting that if you look at the split between science and religion in the Western world, the way I put it was religion, not science, that filed the divorce papers. And then it's one of those classic cases where a married couple, you know, one of the people decides to end the relationship and the other person is saying, no, let's stay together. No, I want to move on. And then the person that initiated the divorce ends up miserable and the person who was rejected finds someone better and ends up very happy and everything gets reversed. I mean, we've all seen things like that. So that's basically what happened in the West. The church, I'm using broad generalizations and there are exceptions and footnotes, but this is basically what happened. That the church basically rejected the science. So to give an example, even as late as the early 1700s, the great universities of Europe, which were all under the control of the church, were teaching Ptolemaic astronomy. I mean, this is decades after Newton. Newton was like the you know, Sir Isaac Newton was the big game changer, but they were still teaching astronomy that went back, you know, almost 1,000 years. And so, not 1,000 years, but back the time of the Greeks in Alexandria. And that's why even in the 1700s, you have all these intellectual salons in Europe, in Paris and London and other places, because the best minds in Europe couldn't get jobs in the universities. Mm. And so it's very interesting because and even after Newton, because Newton was like the water said, Newton is like, there's like pre-Newton, post-Newton in terms of the intellectual history of Europe. But even after Newton, learned scholars in European universities are writing these, you know, papers, academic papers on how you can identify the true witch so that you make sure you kill the right person. So this was going on. And then basically, as we know, the world changed. I mean, the French Revolution was a huge event. And the Industrial Revolution, because it was really when people learned how to apply science, applied science, technology, that it gained power. Because applied science, technology means money, Industrial Revolution, and you get a whole new upper class in Europe. You have all these people buying their way into power, and the traditional powers are gone. It was the traditional powers that, of course, worked with the church hand in hand to control everything. So everything gets changed. But when all the dust clears, as they say, to make a long story short, when all the dust clears, there's a new power. It's like the king is dead, long live the king. So now it's the agnostics who control the universities. And just as, for example, the Romans used to persecute Christians, and as soon as Christians took power, they began to persecute pagans, actually. So when the material sciences gained power in the universities, they began to persecute the theologians and the religionists just as they had been persecuted. So it was like, it's not that we became freed from fanaticism, we just, you know, a different party won. But it was the same fanaticism, the same blind rejection of half of reality. So I would like to now put forward for your consideration, I think, obvious facts in the world that demonstrate that all of us live in a bi-dimensional universe, and that therefore, by definition, no material science or empirical science a priori, actually, I mean, as a logical truth, no empirical science can ever give a complete explanation of reality. And so here I go. This is just water, but spiritual teachers have to fortify themselves with water. So let's see, how do I put it? Denmark. For example, Denmark recently was voted as having the most honest government in the world. So if you're dissatisfied, imagine the rest of the world. I mean, I'm from America, where we have the honor and the pleasure of living in a plutocracy, which is ruled by the rich. So, but democracy. Now, democracy is considered to be the standard acceptable form of government for civilized countries. If a country is not democratic, it does not have a truly civilized, enlightened political system. And the rest of the world works together through economic, political pressure, sometimes even by military intervention, to civilize that country and bring it to democracy. So we can just look at democracy, which obviously is so central to modern political philosophy. Democracy is based on a simple assumption, which is that we are all equal. As human beings, we're all equal before the law, and therefore we all deserve equal justice. Now, one of the most interesting things about this equality is that from the empirical scientific point of view, it's absurd. For example, here we are, a group of human beings in the room, if some of you is if any of you are actually aliens in disguise from other planets, no offense intended, but you know Men in Black. So, but here we are, and any possible any possible test that we could give to ourselves, any conceivable test would show, empirical test, that we're not equal. We could test ourselves, we could give ourselves tests that are athletic, musical, mathematical, physical, social skills, I mean, you name it. Any conceivable test would show that we're not equal. And so it's very interesting because we live in this age in which we're, well, you know, governments are supposed to be sort of rational and scientific, not religious, but our governments are actually based on religious assumption. Because since we're not physically equal, there's only one thing left. We're metaphysically equal. I mean, what else could there be? If you say we're morally equal, fine, that's metaphysical. Morality is metaphysical. For example, say justice or say compassion. Compassion is not like rubber, iron, or steel. It's not a physical object. There's no physical object called a justice, an equality. I mean, it's metaphysical. So it's interesting, just to, if I can indulge myself in a little American history here. We have a document called the Declaration of Independence, written by Thomas Jefferson, who was a smart guy. President Kennedy once made this famous remark when he invited all these Nobel laureates to have dinner at the White House, and he said, "This is the greatest gathering of intelligence. This is the greatest gathering of intelligence at a White House dinner since the time when Thomas Jefferson dined alone." And so, so it's interesting, Jefferson. He knew his philosophy because at the time of Jefferson, one of the most prominent philosophers in Europe was David Hume. And Hume, in fact, Kant, the philosopher Kant, German philosopher Kant, made a famous statement that before Hume, we were all sleeping. We all took important things for granted, and Hume woke us up. What Hume did that sort of woke up the European philosophers is that he made a very simple, I mean, he did a lot of stuff that's kind of silly, but he did do one very important thing. And that is, he said that you cannot derive a metaphysical fact from a physical fact. And I'll explain what I mean by that. For example, let's say someone commits an obvious act of injustice, such as killing an innocent person. So it's not controversial. Everyone knows it's an evil act. It's an act of injustice. So if we study that act, for example, forensically, the police forensic experts will come in and they'll study exactly how the murder took place, if there was a gun used, what type of gun it was, the distance between the victim and the killer, the angle, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's all this forensic stuff they do. So you could describe that immoral act empirically. You can describe that act forensically, physiologically, in so many different ways, but no empirical description of the act will reveal an injustice. You can say, well, this person, it was a child, it was an innocent person, but then you have to say that people shouldn't harm innocent people. But in English, I mean, I'm sure you have the same thing in your language, but in English, any sentence which contains the auxiliary verb should or must is a metaphysical claim. If I say, for example, Mary takes care of her child, that's simply a description. That's a descriptive statement. If I say Mary should take care of her child, that's a prescriptive statement. It's saying it's a moral judgment. It's a correct one in this case, but still, it's a moral judgment. It's not an empirical fact that, let's say, parents should take care of their children. That's not an empirical fact. It's not something that you can, something that happened, a physical event. It's a value. It's namely valuing love, valuing compassion, valuing the responsibility of parents to our children. Now, what's interesting here is that if you accept a purely empirical view of reality, then you would have to say, you would have to come to a monstrous, a horrible conclusion, which would be, let's say, if just as lions, male lions, sometimes kill their own children, apparently male lions can be very competitive. That's a great example of male ego, right? So male lions kill their own children. Now, let's say we make the statement that, you know, fathers, human fathers shouldn't kill their children. According to evolution, there's absolutely nothing wrong with killing one's own children. There's nothing wrong with massacring large numbers of people. For example, let's say you are an ecologist, environmentalist. If you had no other concern but environmentalism, you had no other moral concern, then you would conclude logically, rationally, that we should kill about, let's say low figure would be 4 billion human beings. If you wanted to really clean up the planet, maybe 6 billion. You know, if you really want to do it right. Now, from the evolutionary or empirical point of view, there's nothing wrong with that. And if someone says, that's terrible, you can't kill billions of people, it's just that evolution, blind evolution, has neurologically wired that person to think that. Because obviously nothing exists except empirical things. And since values, moral values, are not empirical, they don't really exist. They're human imagination. And therefore, there's really nothing wrong. I mean, Hitler didn't really do anything wrong. The only thing he did wrong was strategic, not moral. He shouldn't have invaded Russia. He should have just been happy with a European superstate. So, I mention this just because we should know what the logical consequences are to materialism. If you say that everything is done by evolution, evolution makes us think certain things, then you have to accept the consequences. Then you cannot logically see anything wrong with anything. In other words, there's nothing a human being can do which is wrong. Genocide, no problem. You are not logically entitled to say it's wrong. All you can say is evolution wired us, created this illusion in our minds. Because gene pools, you know, human beings that believe this fantasy that genocide is bad, for example, or raping and brutalizing women is bad, gene pools, human beings that believe that survive better. It's actually not clear they would survive, but that's another point. That's a historical issue because it's not even clear that, let's say, morality gives you a survival advantage. So here's the point. Now I'm getting to the point of the bi-dimensional universe. All of us, I hope, at the core of our being, not just as sort of an intellectual preference, but in the deepest part of ourselves, we know that certain things are really wrong. Like, for example, killing innocent people is really wrong. It's not just a story our genes tell us. It actually is wrong. Or, for example, parents should love and take care of their children. It's not just a story. It actually is true. Anyone who's ever loved their own child knows that it's real. It's not a story. It's not just a neurological myth. It's actually real. Or anyone who's ever loved anyone. Or, for example, the fact there's beauty in the world. There really is beauty. So if you are committed to some things are really right and some things are really wrong, like loving your children is right and killing them is wrong, if you're committed to that, if you're committed to justice, if you're committed to equality, then you are very strongly committed to a bi-dimensional universe. Philosophy is like psychology. Even if you don't study it, you have one. Even if you don't study psychology, you have a psychology. You can't say, I don't have a psychology because I don't study it. In the same way, you can't say, I don't have a philosophy because I don't study philosophy. Everyone has a philosophy. And it turns out that our philosophy is that the universe is bi-dimensional. namely its physical and metaphysical, as Aristotle said. So, that being the case, just as, for example, Denmark, it's just, I could go on all day, you know, praising Denmark. I really like it. But, control myself right now. One thing I really like about Denmark is that there's so many things that people just do right. It's like, I mean, just environmentally, or, of course, you live here, so you probably see all the mistakes. But for someone coming from, I've just been to so many countries, and it's just so many things are done right here. I mean, the people are nice, the way they organize the country, it's just, you know, I mean, people ride so many bicycles. When I was in Copenhagen, it was like, oh my God. it was like some science fiction movie, Attack of the Bicycles. But it's really great. I mean, it's just so intelligent. So just as when you do things materially in a rational way, logically, so that you actually promote the public good, or you do promote the public good by doing things in a rational way, so we also have to have a metaphysical science. I mean, how can we be scientific about one half of life and irrational and random and just unthinking about what is ultimately the more important part of life? Because after all, in Denmark and other civilized countries, people have given their lives for freedom, to protect their families and other people. But those are, in other words, people have given up everything they possessed materially, their bodies, their life, to protect something metaphysical. Freedom, justice, or just to protect those they love. And so when it comes down to it, human beings ultimately place the greatest value on metaphysical things. And that's why Aristotle gave the word metaphysical, because meta means beyond. In other words, there's the physical, and then beyond that, there's the metaphysical. So, after that brief little preface, what I wanted to say is that, okay, first here's the good news. The good news is that, or here's one bit of good news, that after centuries of religion persecuting science, and then science persecuting religion in the universities, wherever else they could, there now the world, at least in Western universities, the tendency now is toward reunification of knowledge. I mean, it hasn't gone that far down the road, but it's definitely going in that direction. For example, in general, at the best universities in America, like the one I went to, Harvard, and other universities, they're trying to reintegrate knowledge. University, the word comes from the concept that there would be a place where you would have universal knowledge. The idea, that's why they gave the name university. In one place, everyone, people who do geology, biology, history, philosophy, theology, they can all talk to each other. They can all talk to each other, and that there will be a learned conversation which will produce universal knowledge. And so that was the idea of the university. And, of course, it never achieved that ideal because, like I said, you know, religions persecuted secular scholars and secular scholars persecuted, you know, theology. And then there was another problem, and that is that knowledge became so specialized. Science had so much success, especially applied science, that in the humanities, everyone wanted to ape the scientists, to use that word, to imitate the scientists. So, I mean, it gets a little ridiculous. Like, I heard this interview on public radio, I was in Los Angeles, and they're interviewing this famous architect who had just unveiled this remarkably ugly building that he had done. In America, I mean, actually, it's what I was saying, actually, a lot of people, I mean, many people agree with me that in America, if you go to a big university, you can always find the architecture school. Just look for the ugliest building on campus, and you will have found the architecture school. So anyway, they were interviewing this architect, and he actually said this. I was thinking, oh, my God, he actually said this. Because the interviewer said, well, some people don't love this building. And so he said, well, it's just like we don't ride in horses and carriages now, we drive in cars. So he was actually comparing aesthetics aesthetics. He was comparing art, architecture, to technology. That just as technology advances, architecture also is objectively superior, which is, of course, absurd. But anyway, he didn't understand physics and metaphysics. But now there's a tendency to reunite knowledge. That's the point I was making. So that people are starting to talk to each other. And so, for example, if you want to understand history, if you want to be a serious scholar of history, you have to know languages, you have to know original languages, you have to know sociology, you have to know something about psychology, and you have to know something about the interface between environmental issues and public behavior. You have to know something, the role of economy. I mean, obviously, Marx, I always say about Karl Marx, he was a great historian and a terrible prophet. But Marx definitely showed the relationship. Marx showed the relationship between the means of production, to use his term, you know, how a society fulfills its needs, and political and social structures. So you really can't study history unless you know something about all that stuff. And even in religion, for example, if you want to study, let's say, Buddhism or Islam or Hinduism or Christianity, you have to know all kinds of things about history, languages, sociology, economics. And so there's a tendency now toward the reintegration of knowledge. And there are even many conferences, academic conferences going on between spiritual leaders, religious leaders, and scientists. And, you know, we can go into all, like, the discoveries of physics, you know, the uncertainty principle, and the fact that, you know, with quantum physics, quantum mechanics, the kind of, and that was the fact that the observer affects the observed phenomenon, and so therefore consciousness plays a role. Before that, they wouldn't even admit that consciousness exists. I mean, whoever has power, whether it's a church or a science, will undoubtedly produce unlimited silliness. But at least the good news now is that there's a reintegration of knowledge. And so in a sense, the word is, it's okay, it's intellectually respectable to be interested in God. It's interesting because people tend to be conditioned. For example, to show you the foolishness of much of modern culture, we have a very common term, which I'm sure you have in Danish. In English, it's blind faith. How do you say it in Danish?
Same. Blindtro.
Yeah, exactly. I really knew it, but I just wanted to see if you knew it. So blind faith. Now, from an epistemological perspective, it is just as dangerous to doubt what is true as it is to believe what is not true. For example, let's say someone has a disease and there's really a cure for the disease, which is not worse than the disease. There's actually a cure for the disease, but someone doubts it. No, I don't believe it. I mean, I personally, just within my own spiritual tradition, I know a number of people in America who actually died because they refused, they died of curable diseases because they had somewhat fanatical views, like I only want this kind of medicine and not that kind of medicine. They actually died, and they could have been living. So anyway, the point is, I just got into this whole medicine thing. Yes, blind faith. So blind faith. So the point I mentioned, like, for example, if you, anything. Let's say someone falls off a ship and is in the water and a rescue boat comes, but the person doubts. No, I think this is a conspiracy of the Trilateral Commission, and they're going to take me to some horrible place and torture me or something. So the person doesn't accept the help and dies in the ocean. So doubting what is true is no less dangerous than believing what is not true. And yet in our culture, we do not have a common phrase or not phrase, common term, blind doubt. I mean, in American English, no one says blind doubt. I mean, I don't know about Danish. I mean, does anyone say blind doubt? No, you say blind faith. So that means that among so-called intellectuals, among people who imagine they're intellectuals, it is doubt, let's say like agnosticism or doubt, is respectable. It's intellectually respectable even if you don't give good reasons for it. Whereas faith is not intellectually respectable even if you have good reasons. So I find this fascinating. It's just a little bit of sort of intellectual history in terms of Western culture. It shows, obviously, prejudice. It's obviously a case of intellectual prejudice. And so it's also, I think, another way to understand the irrational opposition to spirituality in certain parts of Western culture, is that we have to go to the realm of psychology now, which is there's a phenomenon I'm sure you know about called post-traumatic stress disorder. So the symptoms, you know, the post-traumatic, the trauma is over, but the emotional problem is still there. And so the symptoms of PTSD, as we call it, the symptoms are, one of the chief symptoms is hypervigilance. Hypervigilance. In other words, typical example, someone is a combat veteran, say in America, and a car backfires, like, and so, you know, he dives for cover because he thinks, you know, oh my God, someone's shooting at me. So it means you're hypervigilant. Your nervous system has been shocked, and therefore the nervous system wants to defend itself against another shock, and therefore it won't even get close to anything which might possibly be a repetition of the traumatic event. And so with hypervigilance comes the second symptom, which is withdrawal. That as soon as something could possibly be traumatic, a person just withdraws. So, next fact. The history, how do you say, the history of religion in the West is traumatic. I don't mean to say every religious person was a serial killer. I just mean to say that if you look at the religious history of the Western world, it is extremely traumatic. I mean, we all know Crusades, Inquisitions, this, that, the other. And the interesting thing is if you actually read the history, it's worse than you think. It's actually worse than you think. And so, and another fact, so I'm just putting together this case here. Another fact is that post-traumatic stress disorder occurs not only individually, but occurs collectively. You can have traumatized families. You can have traumatized communities. You can have traumatized countries. You can have traumatized Europe. And it's transmitted, you know, a progenie in progenie, you know, that famous Latin phrase, from generation to generation. It's actually, for example, let's say birds who live in a particular area in a city where human beings sometimes kill birds. And so birds observe other birds being killed, they're traumatized, and they transmit this trauma to their children. So you know, when birds or animals or humans are raising their children, they transmit to the children their own terror at certain dangerous things. And so in terms of the intellectual history of the West, what we're really seeing is a type of, at a civilization level, in Europe, post-traumatic stress disorder, where obviously not everyone, but a significant number of people are hyper-vigilant about ultimate religious claims. Like if someone says, here we have the highest truth, oh my God. It triggers this PTSD. And so therefore, in America, it's, you know, the same thing among certain people. So, but the problem is that this emotional disorder at a social level, at a civilization level, does not allow people to be objective. It actually does not allow you to be completely rational and objective. and to, in a detached way, pursue your self-interest, either intellectually, spiritually, or however. And so, so here I am in Europe. Hi, everybody. In California, typical American. Hi, everybody. So, and you know, we're trying to teach Krishna consciousness, and it's a very interesting. I mean, I love Europe in general. I actually have studied European history much more than American history, and I love European music and architecture and literature and so on. So I'm kind of a Europhile. But here I am in Europe, and in trying to teach this spiritual thing. I'm in California. We call everything a thing. It's either a thing or stuff. Everything in the universe is either a thing or stuff. So, and that's what's really needed. Because if we don't have a metaphysical... Because otherwise, how do you calculate the rational self-interest of a society ultimately? Like moral things. There are no fixed points, because now in Europe or in America there are certain moral principles. But as we know, as we saw very clearly in Germany in the 1920s and 1930s, that when economic situations become very severe, serious economic situations produce political chaos, produce extremism, and so on. And ultimately now, just like Europe is struggling with all these issues, obviously the immigration crisis, it's a great moral challenge. So there has to be, ultimately, if we want unity in the world, and so the barbarians don't win, you know, so the good guys actually win, there has to, how should I put it? Someone may be a Hindu, but obviously most people aren't Hindus, and not everyone's Christian, not everyone's Jewish, not everyone's Muslim. So there are always going to be different religions. There are always going to be different religions. There will always be different political approaches. People will always have different philosophies. But what ultimately has to unite the world is the understanding that we're all spiritually equal. And interestingly, Krishna defines yoga in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna actually defines yoga as equality. I just did a book on the Bhagavad Gita. I just produced the Gita, and that's actually why I came here to make money. I mean, what did you expect? You know where I'm coming from. So, I just did a book on the Gita. In order to do this book, I had to really study it. I've read the Gita all my life, but I had to really dig in at a more technical level. And one thing that surprised me in my research is how much Krishna emphasizes equality. Equality is one of the major topics in the Bhagavad Gita. In fact, Krishna says you cannot achieve pure love of God unless you see everyone equally. And Krishna says that wise people see everyone equally. That when your intelligence is virtuous, when your worldview, your understanding is truly virtuous, you see behind all the variety, different genders, different races, ethnicities, species, different political and religious groups, that behind all that, there's a oneness of all life. There's a oneness of all life. And Krishna says, if you don't see the oneness behind the variety, then your consciousness, your understanding is simply contaminated. Contaminated by selfishness. You know, the selfishness. No, my family's better than your family. My country's better than your country. My religion's better than your religion. So because of this vanity, because of this passionate vanity and pride, we become blind to the oneness of all creatures. Therefore, for example, there's actually, I mean, I hate to talk about conspiracies because there's so many, you know, sort of crazy conspiracy theories going around. But it is a fact that the international, this is not about 9/11, the international environmental community, they have these very high profile events, like they're going to meet in Paris now, you know. And it's interesting that they absolutely refuse to talk about the number one cause of greenhouse gases, which is, of course, animal slaughter because of the feed laws. And so the United Nations issued a report saying that the cattle industry produces more greenhouse gases, in this case methane, produces more greenhouse gases than all of the motorized vehicles on Earth. And that means planes, trains, cars, trucks, boats. All the motorized vehicles on Earth produce less greenhouse gases than animal slaughter. And so it's amazing because, like, I was speaking at the University of Florida a few years ago, and they had all these, you know, cute little recycle containers, like, recycle, you know, put it in the right container, and everyone is like, feel so good about themselves. And then right next to all these little cute little recycle things was a student restaurant serving meat. Which I mentioned in my lecture that night that this food stuff is doing 100 times more damage than your recycling is doing good. But they will not talk about it. There's actually a very good movie. I think it's on YouTube now. You can find it. It's called Cowspiracy, like conspiracy, but it's called Cowspiracy, and it's not made by, you know, someone from my tradition, but he goes around, he interviews in America all the most important, the leaders, the most important environmental organizations, and he asks them about that, and they just, like, they won't talk about it. They really won't talk about it. That's the number one problem. And so that shows you the limitations of humanism. Humanism is actually like racism or sexism, because humanism means that you judge people or you deny people their rights. You deny people their rights because their body is different from your body. Whoops, I have a male body, you've got a female body, sorry. Or I have a white body, you don't have a white body, sorry, you have no rights. Or I have a human body, you have a non-human body. Even if science shows you have you have rather complex emotions, you think, you communicate, but your body is different from my body. No rights. You're food. And it's very interesting because if you think of the worst kind of government, it's like there's this great English novel from around 1840s called Jane Eyre. I don't know if any of you know this, by Charlotte Bronte. It's one of the greatest of all English novels. They've made, like, you know, 39 movies of it. Anyway, in the beginning of the story, there's this girl, Jane Eyre, she tells the story. It's told in the first person. It's her story. And she's being abused by her stepbrother and her stepmother. And at one point, her stepbrother attacks her. And she gets so furious. She finally fights back. But she gets so angry, she says, you're like the Roman emperors. You know, that's the line. So if you think about it, the Colosseum, which was interesting, the Colosseum, where all these atrocities were committed, was built by the money the Romans got when they destroyed the Second Temple in Jerusalem. When the Romans destroyed the Temple in Jerusalem and took all the wealth from Israel, that's what they used to build the Colosseum, where they could, you know, kill people for sport. Anyway, so, I mean, just consider that the Roman emperor, he puts his thumb up, you know, the gladiator lives, the gladiator dies. The gladiator has no rights. All the power is in the ruler. So in the same way, if an animal makes a cute urban pet, I mean, for obvious reasons, people who live in cities don't keep cows as pets. But, you know, dogs and cats. So if an animal is a cute urban pet, it has rights. In America, I'm sure in Europe, for example, there was a case. There was a member of American aristocracy, real American aristocracy. He was a football star. He was a quarterback. That is American aristocracy. But it came out that he was sort of abusing dogs. He was arranging dog fights. and they would kill dogs. He would personally throw them down. And the public was so shocked, he actually went to jail. You know, he was this guy making millions of dollars, NFL quarterback, and he went to jail for a few years. And yet, all the people, all the Americans, oh my God, that's so terrible, and they talk about it over their steak dinner. So what's interesting is, there are many laws protecting, say, dogs and cats. Why? Because they make cute urban pets, and humans bond with them. And you see these posters in America like, I lost my dog Tabby. Tabby's a cat. I lost Tabby. She's a member of the family. We love her. Please, if you find her, you know, $12 million reward. And so what's interesting here is that, you know, people really emotionally bond with these things. So if it's not that creatures have rights. They don't have rights. But if you like them, if humans like them, then they have rights. It's like the worst kind of corrupt justice. You know, you're the judge. I like you, dude. You're free. Or I don't like you, man. You're toast. You know, you're... And actually, this goes, I mean, this was Plato's objection to Homer in the Iliad and the Odyssey, because Zeus is like this adolescent gang member or something. You know, because Zeus, like, I don't like that guy down there, that soldier. And Hera say, why not, Zeus? I don't know, I just don't like him. I'm just gonna smash him. Or Hera say, I like that guy. Why do you like him, Hera? I don't know, I just like him. I'll protect. So Plato objected to this. That there was this is how could gods behave in this absurd way? Where there's no justice, it's just, you know. So but that's the nature of Western laws concerning animals. If we think, oh, he's so cute. Okay, you have rights. You know, no, it's just some big mammal that gives us dairy products. It's no rights. So that's why humanism is analogous to sexism and racism, because it's depriving people of their natural rights because their bodies are different or you don't like their bodies. So that's just an example of why we need a type of metaphysical science. We need to be logical. We need to be consistent. And in the Bhagavad Gita, there's all this knowledge. So we're promoting that. I haven't got a chance to really harass you about this in this lecture, but anyway, we're recommending you read Bhagavad Gita, and it really does present a spiritual science. That's why I actually began my own spiritual practice. I had no interest in joining some religion. I can honestly say that. I already had a religion. I mean, I was born, my parents had a religion. It was nice. There was God. There was love of God. You know, it was good enough. And so the point is that I was looking for a spiritual science. You know, it's not that I was lonely and some religious group gave me a lot of attention and fed me and, you know, I bonded with them. No, I had lots of friends. I was really happy. And I already had a religion, so I just wanted to find a spiritual science, which is not sectarian. It's not like the old Testament view that my God can beat up your God. It's just spiritual science. That's what we're trying to present. So maybe I'll stop there before you start walking out. So any questions on these points? Yes.
I agree with everything you said. But
you have to agree. You already joined the same cult.
Just to play the devil's advocate philosophically, yes, on the first part of your lecture when you were establishing the point of bi-dimensional universe, one may claim that you made two sort of very loaded assumptions. Spoke in one sentence and then went on.
Uh-oh. What's coming next?
I was wondering if you could address them.
Well, you didn't tell me what the loaded assumptions were.
Yeah. So the first one, and you made them one after the other. One is the idea that intrinsically, deep down, ontologically, every human being has an objective, common to everyone, notion of what is right and what is wrong.
No, that's not what I said, actually. Okay. Since we're getting into a little philosophical discussion, we have to be precise here. What I said was that not that everyone has exactly the same idea. We know there are cultural differences. However, what scholars find, whether it's historians or anthropologists or whatever, is that people have the same basic notions of justice, but they may apply them differently. Because the basic notion of justice is quid pro quo, that people get what they deserve. So, for example, a society may say that... it's interesting. For example, economically, we have a society. Of course, in Europe, there's more socialism than in America. In America, it's funny. Europe's kind of like a little more sane in that regard. Because in Europe, you can actually say the word socialist and without everyone attacking you and wanting to, find the highest tree and lynch you. But still, even in Europe, there are economic differences. So there's the idea that economically, if someone has ability, if someone has talent, and they make money, okay, that person earned it. Or, for example, in sports, if someone just has more ability, they win, or this team wins, or intellectually, the smartest person should get the job as the professor of whatever. And so, Europe has so many hierarchies, or America. The West has so many hierarchies, intellectually, economically, socially, but somehow there's the idea that politically, these hierarchies somehow don't count. In other words, even if someone is very well informed about public issues and someone else has absolutely no idea what's going on, they have the same right to decide how the country should be governed. So knowing what you're talking about is irrelevant. Now, I'm not arguing against democracy. I'm just showing how it's possible for rational human beings to come to different conclusions. I don't know if everyone says it in Denmark. In America, it's so common. People say democracy is not a very good system, but it's the best one that people have come up with. Oh, my God. They say it here, too. Mm-hmm. The people that say that, probably what they almost all have in common is they've actually never studied history. But anyway, the simple point I want to make is that I personally am happy with democracy. I'm simply saying that a rational person could come up with a different political philosophy. Not because that person is evil or a fascist, but just because they have different they've studied history and they have different political philosophy. So, but still, the sense of justice. For example, the idea we should do the greatest good for the greatest number of people. Or the idea that people should get what they deserve. There should be justice. They're basic universal notions which are applied differently based on the values. Based on the values of a society. The values differ, but the underlying notions tend to be the same. But I was actually making a different point. And that is, the different point was that almost everyone, there are sociopaths out there. But I would say anyone who's not a sociopath or a psychopath, any normal person, knows that some things are really wrong. That some things are really wrong. And if you think that anything at all, is really wrong, then you live in a bi-dimensional universe.
And that was related to the second thing you said after.
Which is?
The sort of Platonic assumption that there are absolutes, that there is such a thing as beauty. There is such a thing as, you didn't mention, justice. And there are kind of sort of absolute values or entities out there, very Platonic.
Not an entity. For example, I'm staying near that, I forgot the name of the place. It's just south of here.
Eiskop.
What?
Eiskop.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. In general, Denmark is, I took the boat over from, to Ireland. It's really beautiful. And so I think most people really feel that some things are beautiful. That some things actually are beautiful. And there is very widespread agreement. Now if someone says, there's nothing beauty, I don't care about anything, it's all horrible or nothing's beautiful or it's, I think most people tend to think that person is somewhat unfortunate. So there is, for example, there are certain people in the world, in Denmark or America or anywhere else, who are considered very beautiful. And almost everyone in the world would agree. I mean, you say, well, it's not my type. You know, he or she is not my type, but it is a good-looking person. I mean, there's very, very widespread agreement on these things, or beautiful scenes in nature. So, you know, someone may have learned that it's intellectually respectable to relativize that. You know, so someone maybe is not saying what they really feel, it's just that they want to be intellectually respectable. So they say, well, that's just, you know, totally subjective. No, it's not. Some things are really beautiful. Yes?
The capacity to appreciate these, like, universal things like truth or equality or justice and these kind of things, is that something that is... Well, except, as you said, like sociopaths or psychopaths, is that natural for each one, or is that something that you can train and you can develop, like also to appreciate maybe something higher, like the existence of God or things like that is maybe not directly perceived as,
right.
For example, justice and equality that is like more... accessible.
Actually, if you study history, you find that even like people, I went in Lithuania, where was I? In Warsaw. They have a Jewish history museum in Poland. And when you go through that, it's like you come out kind of shaking. Because at the end of the museum, you walk this whole Holocaust thing, and it's, I mean, you know, I've heard about it a million times, but when you actually see these pictures, it's pretty horrifying. So, and you find that, you know, so-called ordinary human beings under the wrong circumstances become killers, you know, mobs, where they'll just turn on their neighbors and just people they've known all their lives and just start murdering them. And so, I mean, Freud talks about this. Freud talks, just after I finish this, you can, I don't want you to have to. So, you know, Freud talks about... Actually, I'll do something really wild here. I'll refer to Freud. I mean, Freud's really good. I mean, he has some good things. There was one scholar at Harvard, actually. He studied Freud's attitude toward religion and found that according to Freud's own categories, Freud's attitude toward religion was pathological. So, apart from his kind of clinically pathological attack on religion, if you look at his contribution, Freud's real contribution, you know, the superego, the ego, and the id. And so, you all know that, right? And so, obviously, if the superego is not functioning properly, by superego, for example, your parents having good family, having a good society that teaches you to be, not to rape, not to kill, not to steal, not to abuse other people. And so in situations where the superego is not functioning in a healthy way, or the superego itself, it kind of merges with the id. I mean, imagine something like some kind of horrible fascist regime where the so-called superego, the government, the power, really has become an incarnation of the lowest form of the id. So you have all this like primitive violence and cruelty, which now is the superego. Or on the other hand, you know, love is like money. When you get a lot of love, you have love to give. And so, as far as God, I'd like to approach him a slightly different angle, the idea of God, or what other, you know, absolute truth, whatever word doesn't trigger a trauma. The point is that ultimately, if someone is not trying to understand the highest truth, call it God, call it the absolute, whatever you want, they have really abandoned, they have really given up the project of rational human life. Because just as, let's say, in the realm of physics, they're trying to find the ultimate equation that explains all equations. Or, for example, that famous problem, Einstein, quantum mechanics, and this and that. And so trying to find an ultimate explanation that explains everything. Because if you just have, well, we have this reality and that reality, and they don't fit together perfectly, everyone knows. Every good physicist knows we're not there yet. We're not there. It's too messy. Because we got, there's this aspect that it's just, so when you've got a theory which is messy, you're not there yet. It's interesting because there's this aesthetic assumption that when you actually find the truth, it should be clean, it should be coherent. There's this assumption that somehow or other, since the world somehow fits together, there is a reality and everything actually, I mean, you mentioned one of the, Heidegger. You know, just talking about existence, I won't go into Heidegger, but talking about existence as existence, everything does fit together. There's something seamless about reality. And therefore, there must be an explanation which is like reality, because if the explanation is not like what it explains, it's not a complete explanation. You're not there yet. Mm-hmm. And so in the same way, oh, I know, okay, now I shall keep my promise, my campaign promise to you, that I said, so because any normal human being who's not a sociopath lives in a bi-dimensional universe where values are real, justice is real, freedom is real, love is real, compassion is real. Therefore, empirical science, by its own rules, it's very interesting because empirical science, in its determination to keep religion out of science, for various historical reasons, they were, you know, like, over my dead body, you're going to bring religion into science. So they were really determined. So therefore, they set up the rules of the game. Sorry, you don't meet the rules. So they set, but the rules that keep religion out keeps metaphysics out. So therefore, science, as science, cannot talk about metaphysics without breaking their own methodological rules. And therefore, since science cannot talk about metaphysics, they can't explain it. You can't explain what you can't talk about or investigate. And therefore, a priori, empirical science can never give a complete explanation of reality. Or, for example, if I have a toothache, I don't go to my priest. I go to a dentist. Or, you know, I was in Vilnius, great city, great country, Lithuania. I was in Vilnius, and I flew to Copenhagen. You know, I didn't want someone praying for me. I wanted a real airplane that works. And so, so by definition, I mean, just as, let's say, theology as theology can't build an airplane or fix your teeth, in the same way, science as empirical science cannot explain the metaphysical dimension of reality. And what we've seen is a type of epistemological imperialism. In other words, first, like what you have Luther saying, sola fide, sola scriptura, only faith, only scripture. And then you have, you know, sort of the more fanatical scientists saying, sola scientia. So I'm sorry, back there, you were raising your hand before?
Yeah, I was. I'm really happy you didn't go into Heidegger. But there is one thing about Heidegger, actually. He mentions Kierkegaard 4 times in Silent Sight. Some people have a schnapps every time they say, Salute! When they have this mentioning of Kierkegaard. I wanted to, in the past I could have gone into some academic, dispute. But it all doesn't matter too much anymore. But I would add this thing from Kierkegaard, because now you're in Denmark, and he...
Oh, yeah, Kierkegaard, yeah, Denmark.
Yeah, I studied the history of ideas here, you know, I was graduated many years ago, and I was very fond of Kierkegaard. And he distinguishes between what he calls quality and quantity. So a qualitative aspect of something can never, ever, you know, be reduced from the quantity. So, as you said, a priori, all these things can never be, you know, true love, true, what is really true, love. It cannot be derived from any neural experience or anything like that. But I actually prepared a question for today. I just wanted to add this little thing because it's really great to see the quality aspect, the quality instead of the quantity. So you can use that on everything. Nothing really like terrestrial life or anything can ever be derived from the idea that there are so and so many stars. That's the quantitative, the aspect of quantity. It can never, ever derive anything, oh, so there must be, you know, life. No, life is different. Life has a quality. Anyway, in the Gita, Krishna talks about the devotee a lot, right? So through devotion, you can actually relate to Krishna, to God. But he also says that if we do that, he will take care of us in the sense that he will make this Maya go away as fast as possible, something like that.
Yes.
Yeah. And all this struggle of pain and, you know, identification, ego, or whatever, or the suffering going on right now, everywhere. I really love the equality aspect that you read into the Krishna reading in the Gita. The equality aspect. It must be the key to everything, right? One is one. But my question actually is something like, what's it all for then? I mean, what's
purpose?
Yeah.
Teleology.
If it is to be, you know, literally a good thing to be free from Maya or to,
yes,
to die basically.
To die?
Yeah. To, you know, well, that's maybe very harshly said, but you know, to get out of here. As possible.
Actually, Prabhupada once quoted to me a verse from the Bhagavatam saying that, which says that if someone is really devoted to God, then every world is the same. Because if you see God everywhere, then if you're in heaven or hell, you're seeing the same thing. If I could just mention one point, just very quickly, and then we have to. Did you want to ask a question?
Yeah.
Okay.
There's time for it.
Okay, so I'll just. Like you said, quantity and quality. One example I give is that. Imagine a great work of art in a Danish museum. I was talking to a professor in California. We were just discussing this, and imagine, say, Renoir. For some reason, I just pick Renoir. So imagine there's a work by Renoir. So the simple question: who really understands? I mean, who really understands the painting? Say, in a more profound sense, is it an accomplished art historian or a paint chemist? Because the person that knows the chemistry of paint can tell you how the painting exists, but not why or what the real meaning is. And so, actually, Socrates gives this example. Socrates said he said if someone asks, in the last day of his life, which is described in the work called the Phaedo, Socrates says, if someone asks, why is Socrates here? And someone else says, well, he's here in the prison cell because he's sitting in a certain way. No, that's how I'm here. I'm sitting. That's not why. So purpose and like for example, we now know why the sky is blue. Then you talk about atmospheric science. That's absurd. That's how the sky is blue. Because ultimately something like chemistry can be reduced down to numerical expressions, whereas the quality is the why and the purpose of it. And so as far as like why do anything at all, it's not a morbid philosophy. I mean it's a question of being happy. When someone really falls in love, or say loves a child or loves a parent or just falls in love romantically, I mean, to quote, I think it was Paul in the New Testament, said that love has its own reasons. And so, I mean, when you fall in love, you know that it's something which is self-validating, something which is the most important thing in the world. Mm. And that's why people consider the ones you love, you consider the most important thing in the world. And so love reveals a higher truth of life. And when you find the supreme spiritual love and you love everyone, it's a self-justifying highest truth and provides you the purpose for everything. So, I'm sorry. Thank you for your statement. And yes?
Yeah, I was just... it seems like you put this... these two options only, that one is this materialist option, which you could say is Hume, or is maybe positivism in a more modern context. And the other possibility is this bi-dimensional university, which you didn't really get into that much. So, you know, maybe you would have explained this if I had just had more time to listen to you. But you have this other idea, which is also Kant, you know, the metaphysics and all this. And then it just seems to me that, especially in the 20th century, a lot of people have been trying to get away from positivism, so modern materialism, by going into this opposite direction of, like, actually maybe Heidegger or this social constructivism or a lot of this continental philosophy.
Can you say a little bit about that?
But I mean the whole philosophy of language, this whole idea that even the idea of the natural sciences is actually a construction of language, that it's going back to really philosophy as the main source for everything, that empiricism is just a way of looking at the world. So everything falls back on language.
I think I would say that...
So my point is just, is that not another way of constructing a one-dimensional universe? So based on materialism, but based on what you could say philosophy of language, or you could say like social constructivism.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting. So I'll just respond to it now, because I think your point is...
Yes, thank you. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah. My impression, and it's not something I say a lot, but if I'm wrong, please correct me. But my impression is that some of this postmodern stuff is actually going in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
And so, to me, it's almost going beyond empirical science, but dropping beneath it. And so, I mean, is it related to sort of this attack on objectivity?
Yeah. Like,
yeah. I think that is...
at least on scientific objectivity.
I would say that what we find in the world is a balance between subjectivity and objectivity. For example, just give a simple example. Here we are in this room. And clearly, every one of us is a unique individual. Clearly, every one of us has our own unique way of understanding, perceiving what's going on, whether it's how we respond to the philosophy or even how we respond to the colors in the room or the people in the room. So every one of us is unique. At the same time, there's a very long list of objective facts that we all accept. For example, we're in Denmark, and we're in, you know, the Aarhus area, or I don't think I say that right, but I'm not going to try to say that the way you guys do. So, you know, we're in Denmark, we're in this room, we're talking, we're human beings. I mean, you could actually, there's actually millions of facts that we would all agree on. Even, for example, the fact we're speaking English. And the reason it's so hard, almost impossible, to get computers to have a real conversation, not just when you hear this, say that, but a real conversation, is because language is so incredibly sophisticated. When you, even like, say, an ordinary conversation, the nuances, the subtleties of language, of parts of speech, of syntax and everything, are incredibly complicated and sophisticated. And yet we're all agreeing on that, at least the meanings of words, even if we disagree on ideas, but we all agree on the grammar, so to speak. And so therefore, in the real world, there's a balance between objectivity and subjectivity.
But does that necessarily entail that something has to be metaphysical? I mean, you said initially...
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. But I was more... I'm sort of expressing my displeasure with that idea, sort of that attack on objectivity. Because even the so-called philosophers who attack objectivity can only do so because we understand the objective meanings of words. And so therefore, everyone... you know, more or less agrees on what subjective means or objective. So it's only because there's such a huge objective dimension, they can even talk to us.
And that's, of course, the arguments against this real post-constructivist. But still, you could argue, like from a more reserved perspective, that the reason we can have moral values and aesthetic judgments are because of social constructs. We don't really need metaphysics for this.
No. Actually, that let's say that response would not really address my point. Because what I'm saying is that I'm talking about the quality of the experience. And I'm here I'm getting sort of an epistemological principle, which is called foundationalism. In the sense that, for example, Aristotle pointed out. Aristotle said that whatever you claim to be true, you can be pushed into an infinite regress of proofs. I give this a simple example. Oh my God, every time I give this example, I say, stop giving the same example, think of a new one, because I've been saying this. But anyway, I haven't taken time to think of a new example. So let's say someone claims that water boils at 100 degrees Celsius. Someone says, I don't believe it, prove it. So you put a pot on the stove, thermometer, 100 degrees, water boils. Someone says, I don't believe that's real water. I don't believe that's pure water. I don't believe that's pure mercury in the thermometer. So bring in the water testing chemicals and the mercury testing. They say, I don't believe those are real water testing chemicals. And so you're just pushed into an infinite regress of proofs. And Aristotle said the way you escape that infinite regress, he said it's like an army is being pushed back. The only hope the army has is to take a stand. And so you have to declare sincerely, not just for the sake of winning an argument, that there is a fact which is self-evident. Because if something actually proves itself, then there's no need to bring in an extrinsic proof, and therefore there's no regress. So, and that's called in epistemology foundationalism, that any belief system has to rest upon some foundation.
But they only have that in theology, right? They have dogmatics.
Oh, no. I'll give you an example in empirical science.
Really?
Well, I'll give you an example. Yeah. You can't really get serious about empirical science unless you believe there's actually a world out there. And there is a philosophical position called solipsism, which claims that, in fact, you can never know if there is a world out there or not. All you can ever know is the content of your own mind, that in your mind you think there is. And, of course, Descartes' example, what if there's an evil genius or something? What if one of us is the only real person?
Oh, God.
Ultimate, this is the philosophical reality show, or like, you know.
This is scary now.
Well, fortunately, it's kind of a loony idea. But still, logically, you could say it, that what if one of us is the only real person in this room, and that one real person is in a laboratory somewhere, and because I'll give you another example of something non-empirical yesterday. Not just the song by Paul McCartney, but because yesterday, you can't empirically prove yesterday. If you say, well, here's a newspaper from yesterday, well, maybe you can't really...
So what's the empirical example, the existence of the world?
Yeah, so therefore, in order to do empirical science, thanks for getting me back on message here, in order to really do empirical science, you have to declare that the quality of my experience of the world is such that I cannot reasonably doubt it, that the world exists. Now, you cannot empirically prove that the world exists because that would be the most obvious form of circular reasoning. And so therefore, since you cannot empirically prove that there's a real empirical world, you have to simply say it's self-evident. It is the nature, the quality of my experience of the world that I cannot reasonably doubt. Like it's interesting because in the 1600s, you have Descartes and Sir Francis Bacon going in opposite directions. It's Bacon, who kind of came up with the modern articulation of the scientific method, you know, the controlled experiment, and he sought certainty, you could say, certain knowledge in the empirical world. And Descartes, or however you pronounce it, I think was philosophical. Maybe Bacon wasn't philosophical. He said, well, wait a second. When we study the material world, we study through consciousness. We better first figure out what we are. And then, you know, it's famous. You know, he concluded that I cannot reasonably doubt that I exist. Cogito ergo sum. So, yes, every system of thought, empirical science. For example, let's say you are a subjectivist, or whatever those people call themselves. I don't know what they call themselves.
Well, idealists, basically, is a form of idealism.
Okay. So, if you, like, let's say the position that you explained in the beginning, that what if, maybe you could just say it one more time, so, I mean, that first position, where you said there's not only the two options that I said, but then the third position.
Yeah, being like a kind of social, extreme social constructivism.
Right. You
know, that
right.
Everything is a construct of the concepts that we evolve.
Right. There's the assumption. Yeah. You can't prove that's a fact. In fact, there's a lot of scientific evidence to the contrary. There's a lot of scientific evidence that we are a sort of a balanced combination of nature and nurture, that we are obviously seriously influenced by our society, but we bring something to that experience. We're not blank slates. And so, but even if you have that social constructivism or, you know, whatever particular version of it, you assume that's true. To you, I mean, or to the person who holds that view, it's self-evidently true. Because, I mean, the easiest thing in the world would be to push a social constructivist into an infinite regress of proofs. I mean, that would be like, you know, it'd be like too easy. Wouldn't it be fun? And so therefore, the person that holds that position has to simply say, no, I just know this is true, and I, you know, you'd have to, this is self-evident to me. And so, interestingly, the other epistemological sort of basic position, there's foundationalism, which we are discussing now, and then coherentism, which is that rather than say there's one specific self-evident truth that gets the game going, actually there's a whole system and all the pieces fit together perfectly and mutually support each other in such a coherent way that it's the system itself.
But that would be the social construct way, right? Because you could construct a different set of
I don't think you could. I mean, you could, of course, as a philosophical exercise. Of course, you could, but I don't think you could construct something which would correspond very closely with reality as people perceive it. And I think it's very dangerous to to sever the link between one's intellectual life and what's going on in the real world. And what real people are experiencing, and I think when you get, whether it's in art or philosophy, I think you tend to get very decadent expressions, because there's something about the real world that kind of keeps you grounded. And so ultimately, with all due respect to those people, I think what's really happening there. Is a very long historical trend is running out of gas. It's actually exhausted itself. And that is a type of anti-authoritarianism where you get, I mean, obviously the French Revolution was kind of, you know, the grand opening. You get the French Revolution, and which included and then led to further attacks on theology, and you get the rise of science. And it's almost like they have this children's game in America, maybe you do here also, it's called King of the Mountain, where like there's like a little hill, and so one kid is on the top, and the other kids have to like pull him down, and the next one becomes the King of the Mountain. And so it's like an attack on any type of authority, so that no one is allowed to know anything. No one is allowed to have any type of intellectual authority over anyone. So if a scientist... It's like you see in certain modern art. It's like anti-art is art. It's like you see a certain kind of modern art where the only possible purpose of it is to destroy art. I mean, because there's no other visible purpose in it. And so it's sort of like, it's interesting. To me, it's just another form of vanity, because the scientists have so much prestige right now. Although there's a Hollywood type. If you look at the history of film, you find that one of the most enduring how you put it, a stereotypical character is, in the history of film, is the evil scientist. You know, or the deluded, spaced-out scientist. No, the aliens are friends. We should cooperate with them. You don't understand, Dr. Smith. They're going to destroy the Earth. And, you know, it's like the deluded scientist, the evil scientist, shows the ambivalence people have towards science. But still, I mean, in fact, they have great power. They have great power in the universities. You have this pathetic spectacle of, like, people in the humanities trying to show they're scientific. And it's just like, it's pathetic. I mean, of course, they should be rational and logical and all that, but it's pathetic. And so, you know, philosophers trying to say, you know, we're just here to serve neuroscience. And so they have so much, and so it's always, as soon as someone has power, someone hates the power. And so it's sort of a way, let's bring them down, let's show that they don't really know what they think they know, they're not really the guardians of knowledge. And it's vanity, because actually the only thing we can really know is subjectivism. So it's kind of like a coup d'etat, where you're not the authorities, now we're the authorities. We're the only ones that really know. And what we really know is that no one really knows. It's like never say never. I mean, to me, it's just kind of ridiculous. Because if you say no one really knows, then no one really knows that no one really knows. You know, never say never. So it's, yeah, to me, it's, I'd rather watch a basketball game. In a sense, you know, because it's, but did you want to speak more on that?
No, I'm happy.
But just the final point, I mean, it's very interesting what you said about, you know, I gave two options. And so, I guess I would have to argue, if I want to preserve my little duality here, or my you know, two thing, that I would have to say that even subjectivism is another form of materialism. Because, I mean, even almost like an extreme form of materialism that even denies generalizations and categories. But in any case. But thank you for bringing that up. That was very interesting. So, I guess maybe we'll stop here. But thank you all very much. I have to say I'm impressed by the questions, and no one ever talks philosophy anymore. I mean, if you travel around, it's very rare to find a group of people who can actually speak intelligently about philosophy. And so, yeah, it's really. Plus, you know, some of you laughed at my jokes, which I appreciate. Made me feel good. So, but anyway, thank you very much. It was great to be with all of you.
Thank you.
Danesha.
All right, so out in the kitchen, there's some water for tea if you want to drink a cup of tea before you go. And there's fruit. You can have some fruit to get the blood sugar balanced, maybe. The restroom is where you enter the door out there, on your right when you enter, if you want to visit that. And I'd like to thank Dr. Resnick for
taking
today.
It was a real pleasure to be with you.